Okay, well, thank you very much for giving me some of your time this morning. I'm talking to Joshua Zaman and Barbara Brancaccio, directors of Cropsy. How are you?
Good.
Good. Thanks.
Well, one of the reasons that I took such an interest in your movie in the first place was just because I was familiar with sort of the intertwining, you know, urban legends that are connected with the name and the story. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, so I mean, even as a Boy Scout and as a kid, camping and stuff, it was a story that came up. So how did it go from that to the movie that you guys have made?
Well, I think, you know, the campfire tale of Cropsy, especially as relates to Boy Scouts and sleepaway camps, is definitely relevant and prevalent all across the Hudson Valley in New York State. It's just like the Cropsy Maniac is just an urban legend that's always been told. How did it get into this situation? Well, I think in addition you had an abandoned mental institution, Willowbrook Mental Institution, and there's always urban legends about abandoned mental institutions, specifically about escape mental patients, overcrowding, things like that, kind of the precursor to the Halloween story, the Mike Myers, you know, escape mental patient going crazy.
Right.
You can also see it in, like, Session Number 9, things like that. So the escape mental patient is another prevalent urban legend. At the same time, those were just, again, urban legends, kind of general cautionary tales. Here, in this case, you also had an alleged suspected pedophile, killer pedophile, I guess you could say, going around snatching children. So in the ways that don't wander away from the campsite, don't wander into the abandoned building, here it was don't wander into the woods, another cautionary tale. And so kind of all of them were mixed together to create our story of Cropsy.
And so, I mean, part of the impetus to make the movie, was it kind of to establish what the connection was between these two things?
Yeah. I mean, for us as kids, we can never contextualize that. So as adults, we were able to really go back, and it was very interesting because we were looking at the story and we had all these connections, but then when we applied all like these kind of philosophies of urban legends to it, it really took on an interesting life of its own. Suddenly it all really made sense, what was going on in the community and what was happening. For example, like when we couldn't contextualize what everybody was talking about devil worshiping when we were kids, but when we started to do the research into the urban legends, suddenly it all made sense. It all followed this like very common trajectory.
Now, for those that haven't seen this yet, which is probably most people that are going to be reading this, because it's debuting at Tribeca, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, how do you think it came about that these two things got linked together?
Well, I think that Josh and I both grew up in Staten Island, as you know, mm-hmm. and as he mentioned, there were abandoned institutions sort of in the middle of the island, which also were the backyards to many of our homes, and it was a location where we all kind of played and hung out and, you know, played games and, you know, went on hikes and so forth as kids. And so it, for Josh and I, in kind of constructing the story, we're trying to find the best way to sort of talk about what had happened when we were growing up. We used the urban legend as a context to tell the story. And as we were kind of going back and doing the research and trying to understand what happened to the kids as they had disappeared during our childhood, it seemed evident, or at least to us, plausible that urban legend had come true.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. I think as we've then interviewed other people for the film, they certainly saw the connection between the urban legend that was common on the island and the fact that these children had disappeared. I think that the connection was kind of there, and in our research and putting the film together, we just highlighted.
I also think that, and this is complete speculation, mm-hmm. but you know, Staten Island is made up of cops and firemen and a lot of civil servants. And we think what may have happened was that the police knew that this guy, allegedly Andre Rand, was going around snatching children, but they could never convict him of the crime because they can never find the body. And that's called corpus delicti. No body, no crime. So, but they kind of suspected Andre Rand had been, you know, behind all these missing kids, but they can never, again, bring him trial, convict him, arrest him. So what we believe may have happened is that the police told their kids, don't go into Willowbrook. You know, there is a, you know, there's a pedophile there who's snatching children. And in turn, kids would then go tell their friends. But they pulled the urban legend name, Cropsey, from upstate New York. They pulled it from their sleepaway camps, and they attached that to this pedophile in the woods. I mean, you can't tell one kid to another kid, you know, hey, you know, there's this really scary pedophile out there. That doesn't work. So instead, you call him Cropsey, and suddenly it all makes sense.
Well, Cropsey also kind of represents everything that's kind of scary and negative about, you know, what's happening in the woods. And,
right.
you know.
So.
Right, and you know, actually, when I first read about it, before I had heard about it, you know, there was a little bit of confusion on my part because I didn't realize that the urban legend, actually, the original urban legend, is probably much, much older than this story.
Yeah.
So in the course of your research, were you able to learn anything more about that and if there, you know, how, where that started in the first place?
I think that we only know from our area, of course, our region, but we, in doing, you know, all the research for the film and interviewing as many people as we interviewed, we really learned about everybody's urban legend. It seems, and we interviewed people from all over the country, of course, you know, particularly people who are a certain age group, and it seems that everybody seems to have some variation of the Cropsey urban legend. We call it Cropsey, and I think that that name came from some kind of myth or campfire story that happened in upstate New York, you know, like a judge with his wife in the woods, and you know, somehow some campers burned down his cabin and
right.
lost his wife and child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the story goes on and on, clearly, but people all over the country have some kind of spooky, scary story that's similar, with a similar name, and we thought it was appropriate to kind of explore that, certainly the legend in our own community. And you know, I mean, who knew that these things were really going on? There really was a man living in the woods. He really was snatching children off the street. There were a very definitely a series of disappearances, some that we were able to connect to this person in particular, and some that we weren't. But of course, the more we interviewed people, the more we realized that there are a lot of crimes that are attributed to this particular boogeyman. So, I mean, it just felt like the right, you know, the right direction to go in when telling the story.
Right way to contextualize, you know, mm-hmm. what we were trying to, you know, uncover. Because for us, it was, you know, there was a somewhat of a truth, but. To what he did, but you know, suddenly, you know, he was a devil worshipper. He was, you know, practicing cults.
Also, a part of similar urban legends. You know,
right? There's the kid urban legends, Cropsey the maniac, and then there's the adult urban legends.
The teenagers, you know, like when you're older, it's that devil worshipping,
white yes. slavery rings,
right? You
yes.
know, the whatever heavy metal music, that kind of thing. I mean, all those things become a part of folklore in little communities. So.
Well, you know, I recently interviewed Victor Miller, who was the screenwriter for the original Friday the 13th, and he was the one that kind of came up with the whole Crystal Lake concept and all that. And actually, when I talked to him then, and this is before I had knowledge of your movie, I mentioned the Cropsey legend because I had asked him if that was any inspiration to him, because it, again, it's that same kind of campfire thing of somebody coming back for revenge, somebody that's wronged. It's like
right.
a,
yeah, I mean,
you
it,
know?
I think it comes, you know, Bill Ellis, who's a doctor in Hazleton Campus, Pennsylvania, who's a big
University of Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
or Penn State. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Penn State on the Hazleton Campus. He writes a lot about it and says that the Cropsey legend started somewhere in the Jewish sleepaway camps of the 1950s, basically. basically. Although the name Cropsey goes back much further than that. You know, we've got Cropsey Avenue, Jasper Cropsey, who was a famous landscape painter from Staten Island, interestingly enough, who was a Hudson Valley landscape painter. So the name goes back, you know, in almost to, you know, very early American.
Yes.
But the Cropsey Maniac, you know, it was written about quite extensively, you know, it was told quite extensively in the 50s. And interestingly enough, I feel that, you know, a lot of those stories that were born in the 50s have now played themselves out into popular culture for our kids, you know, for our, when we were kids, i.e. The Burning, right? You know, that was Harvey Weinstein, you know, writing his first screenplay.
And they used the name Cropsey.
And they used the name Cropsey, right? Where did he get that? Did he get that from his Jewish sleepaway camp in upstate New York? Is that where the Friday the 13th did? I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that in the 70s, all these guys were coming out with these kind of slasher horror movies,
yes,
about, like, the wronged guy who, you know, goes and gets everybody. And I would be very interested to find out where they all went to sleepaway camp.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because not to get off on a tangent, but with the Friday the 13th, you know, that guy, Victor Miller, he's from Connecticut. So, and like you say, these urban legends are very regional. So he actually wasn't that up on the Cropsey legend, but he had something up here that I've come to be familiar with since I've lived up in Connecticut called the Melon Heads, which is supposed, have you heard of that one?
Well, there's a couple Melon Heads on ours. You know, we have a Facebook site, and if you go on Facebook and you put in Cropsey, you can see it. And I've just asked, I think Facebook is really interesting because it's almost like you know, it's like our modern day campfire, you know.
Completely.
It can, like, talk in, you know, groups, and I've asked people to tell about their urban legends, and I've heard, you know, numerous different ones. And Melonheads definitely has come up.
Yeah, and it, like you said, it just seems like these things just stick in people's heads and kind of emerge later on when they're...
Of course, you know, you know, you're a budding screenwriter, a budding director, you know, what's more scary than, you know, when you were 8 years old sitting around the campfire? You know, you're going to repeat that, you know, as you get older, and I think that's what happened. But I think today, what we try to do is we try to kind of almost bring it full circle, because here you know, typically, again, urban legends are stories, you know, that discourage you from doing something. Going to, you know, like, what's the one about the woman who comes out of the lake or something like that.
Yes.
You know.
Cautionary tale.
Yeah. Thank you. You know, they're typically cautionary tales. That's why they're created. You know, don't go into, you know, don't go into strange places outside of the country. You're going to get your kidney cut out, you know.
That's a big one. Yeah, that's,
you know, that's a new one.
No, yeah, but, you know, don't wander into the abandoned mental institution, because what's really going to happen is, you know, you're going to fall through a broken floor. But, you know, instead they'll call a Cropsey. And,
you know, in this case, of course, there really was somebody. I mean, Andre Rand was a patient aide at the institution, and he was squatting on the grounds. He had a camp on the grounds of the abandoned mental institution. So,
and there were kids missing.
You know, and there were children missing. So we had every reason to believe that this particular urban legend had come true. Whether we were sort of conscious of that when we were kids or not, I'm not entirely sure of that. But certainly looking back, you know, when you're in your, you know, 20s and 30s and you're kind of trying to take a critical look at what may have happened during that time period, you definitely think to yourself, oh my goodness, you know, this is sort of the nightmare, our parents' nightmare come true, really.
Yeah.
You know, here we were, like, sort of hanging out and playing in the woods with our friends, certainly going there with our girlfriends and boyfriends and having parties and kind of, you know, exploring these old buildings when, in fact, someone was living there. I mean, maybe many more people were living there. Who knows? Certainly the movie sort of addresses the variety of possibilities. And I think the other thing that this film does is that it gave us the opportunity, or at least the framework of Cropsey, gave us the opportunity when we were interviewing people to let them sort of, it was really an exercise in storytelling to some extent. You know, like, everybody who added something about their experience when the kids went missing, you know, they added something else to the story. It became a part of the legend of the island. Now, that didn't take away from the severity of the these cold cases, or the response, or the feelings of people on Staten Island and their dedication to trying to recover these children. But adding, you know, when they shared with us their story, they added a little bit more, and that in and of itself became an urban legend. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, yes, I do. Now, do you think that, and this is for, again, people that aren't familiar with the film, do you think that it was almost a way of sanitizing is the right word, but somehow processing the real life horror of what had happened,
yeah,
but by kind of cloaking it in this obviously, you know, over the top fake kind of legend?
I think whenever we can, you know, especially crimes against children, they're so difficult to comprehend, and so in an effort to contextualize crimes against children, because we can't really understand it as sane individuals, we tend to go and call it good and evil, and in a lot of cases you just kind of go outside the normal realm of what a person could do.
There was also the opportunity to make the film about the community, and not make it solely. Of course, the cases themselves are very powerful, very compelling stories. But I think that the way that the community responded is equally as compelling, and it really speaks volumes about the people on the island, for sure. And so, being able to talk about it in the context of this, you know, of local folklore, local legend, you're totally accurate in saying it didn't sanitize it, but it definitely made all of those experiences very relevant.
And just more interesting.
Mm-hmm. And how did you, how did the two of you come together to work on this movie? Did you have a shared experience of having heard the story as kids? Is that what led you to the common interest?
Well, Barb and I did not know each other growing
right
up, but we had both collectively heard the stories of, the guy roaming in the woods, the escaped mental patient, and we collectively knew from our neighborhood, you know, the disappearances that had happened on Staten Island. And obviously it affected us. We were in high school at the time and very impressionable. When we met later on down in life, when we met and we were just talking and we found out we were both from Staten Island, we immediately turned to each other and said, "Hey, do you remember the story of Jennifer Schweiger? Do you remember the story of Andre Rann?" And then we went, took a hike back to the woods, and, in the middle of the woods, it was amazing, still lying there was the old trike or the old trays. And swing set from Willowbrook.
Children's toys. It was very creepy.
So we were like, I can't believe this stuff is still here. Like, I remember when I was a kid it was here, but as adults for it to still be here. And then when we got back home to Manhattan, we saw that the district attorney had decided to indict Rand for the disappearance of Holly Ann Hughes. And it was like our boogeyman was returning back to Staten Island, and we knew, okay, this is the opportunity to find out really what happened back then. Because part of what we knew as kids in high school, you know, we didn't know any facts. We knew what kids told each other. Everything was half urban legend and half, you know, embellishments and, you know.
I mean, I think it's also just, you know, as a side note, it's worth noting that, you know, Staten Island, it's New York City and very dynamic place. But Staten Island is also it's an island that is a very close-knit community. So even though we didn't know each other as kids, you know, certainly we had friends in common, or everybody lives, like, within 15 minutes of each other. So it's not as if, you know, when we kind of describe, well, Josh lived on one part of the island, I lived on the other side of the island, the truth is, like, we probably lived about 10 minutes from each other.
Right.
But, and, you know, we were either the same age and certainly, you know, went to all of the same places and saw all of the same things, and there really wasn't that, you couldn't really go that far. But, you know, that said, when we did meet, we sort of come together when we were already adults, it just, you know, it's so easy to kind of go back and you get into that whole conversation of, oh, do you know this so-and-so, and, you know, have you been there? And then immediately, because it was such a shared experience for people our age, you know, we started talking about the disappearance of Jennifer Schweiger and then all of the other children, and I would have to say almost immediately, you know, we became interested in kind of looking into it, uncovering a little bit more. So, yeah, I mean, we kind of jumped into the story as soon as we connected.
And would you say now, after all is said and done, are you satisfied with what you were able to find, or did it satisfy your curiosity, or really are there still a lot of unanswered questions for you?
Weirdly enough, all it did was lead us into more questions. We thought it was just maybe about our, you know, a mental institution, maybe one individual, this guy Andre Rand, but what we found was a whole seedy underside to this community that we had never even known about in high school. So in a lot of ways, the urban legends kind of only touched upon really what was there. And again, you know, it's one thing to be investigating kid urban legends. It's another thing when you start to investigate the things that freak adults out.
Also, you know, I don't know that our objective was ever to, like, you know, tie it all up in a neat little bow at the end of it. I mean, certainly answering some major questions, particularly about the whereabouts of the children, would have been ideal.
There's no question about that.
I mean, but that said, the objective in making the film, to some extent, was really about shedding light on this particular story, of course, you know, expanding on that. But I think that we were satisfied in what we got out of it. But I think in terms of, like, the kinds of questions that people in general would want answered, you know, that's just not the nature of, certainly not the nature of documentary. You know, I mean, we.
Some respect,
you know.
Right.
There's only so much you can answer.
Of course. Now, finally, to bring it back to Tribeca, because now it's going to be premiering on Saturday, and then there'll be showings through the following week. How did your movie come to the attention of Tribeca?
Well, I had produced a couple movies before directing Cropsey, and we showed another film called Choking Man at the festival. Obviously, showing the film in New York City has always been a dream of ours. You know, although the film can play, you know, everywhere, because everyone has urban legends and everyone has the spooky stories, it was just really great for us to be able to play it in Tribeca. And, you know, really have to credit David Kwok and Gina Terranova, because, you know, it's interesting. It's a crime film, and kind of crime films get this court TV, kind of mentality. But I believe that, you know, that there are some really amazing, beautiful documentaries that are about crime, and they don't have to all be, you know, America's Most Wanted reruns and things like
right.
that. So a real credit to them for kind of really seeing the creepiness in this very interesting, subtle story, and for understanding how interesting, I'm sure, like a lot of your viewers, like, find the whole fascinating discussion of urban legends and where they sit in our society, and where the truth is, where the truth really does lie. So I think we have to really credit them for being very patient and really nurturing our vision.
Certainly. And do you know what might be up next for the movie? Will it be in terms of distribution, or how people can see it outside the New York area?
Well, the best way to get distribution is for our fans to really come out and support us. And I think, you know, one of the best ways to do that is to sign up to the mailing list that we have at CropseyLegend.com, to jump on Facebook. We are Cropsey is on Facebook. And just, you know, start saying, hey, I want to see this movie. You know, a lot of times in today's world, we use all those, that talk back. We use all that chatter and show distributors and say, you know, hey, I know you're interested in the movie and you're concerned that it might be, that you want to know if it's going to be successful. Look how many people want to know about this. You know, look at them coming to our site and telling us that they want to get this stuff out. So it's really about kind of finding your fans and rallying everybody and convincing, you know, people who hold the purse strings to, mm-hmm. you know, to believe.
Yeah, I think that this is the kind of thing that just appeals a lot of times to people on a gut kind of primordial level, just the mystery of the urban legend and then connecting it to reality. It's just got a natural appeal.
We call all our fans are the legend trippers. Legend tripping. Are you familiar with the term legend tripping?
Yes.
You are?
Yes.
You know, you say you know exactly what we're talking about. You know, it's like legend tripping. It's you know, going to that spooky place in your neighborhood. Every neighborhood has one. Every neighborhood has an abandoned institution, a house, you know, the ravine, the cliff, you know, the cemetery. And it's going there and kind of invoking those spirits. And for us, that's really what it's about. You know, it's about taking that journey and allowing yourself to be scared, which we did in the movie quite often.
Well, I just wanted to thank you. Those are all the questions I have. I want to thank you for giving me a chance to talk to you about this today.
And thank you so much for your interest in the film and for calling us.
Yeah, and I think I'm glad that you're able to see, you know, kind of how what we thought was so cool about it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of other people are going to be able to see that very soon also.
Cool.
Good, thanks. Thanks a lot, Brian.
Thank you. Best of luck.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.